Good evening, James McKenney with My Science for May 5th, 2022. And the first thing I want to talk about is, let's revert back to a few shows ago. In the last few shows, I've been talking about being in Canada, living outside, getting into perfect physical condition, you know, cleaning out everything inside, no toxins, no modern food, just a very pure existence. And then also physical activity every day, and then also spiritual connection with the universe, etc., and many other things like the connection to the vertical electric field, which I've said before, I can walk outside if I'm in a place with a roof, especially a metal roof, and then usually construction has a lot of metal in a roof, and you're not really connected to the atmosphere, so you have to go outside. And so I can actually feel the connection through the top of my head to the vertical electric field. I can feel it. And if you know what this feels like, you would be able to sense it also. Some people talk about walking in the grass in the morning with the dew that's on the grass out on your lawn, and it gives you a physical connection with the earth, and it actually completes the circuit. And so that connects you to the earth and the vibrations of the earth, which the human being is actually tuned to. So a lot of people don't really understand this. There are some people that work with these types of things, and they understand that the human being is very much connected electrically with a physical electrical frequency to the earth. But standing in that dew in your bare feet in the morning completes that connection, gives you a much better connection. And the other way of doing that, of course, is going up to high altitudes where you connect also. It's a much better connection to the vertical electric field. But the thing I wanted to point out here is I would invite people from the city to come up and visit me in the woods. And so I would be going around and we'd go out for a walk in the woods, not a path, not a well-defined path, but in the woods. And you're climbing over trees that are falling down or walking around, and you're constantly moving your muscle sets. There are 600 muscles in your body, approximately. Most of them are little muscles, and those little muscles give you the initial movement before your big muscles take over. So the very first movement, if you take your arm and lift it up, the very first movement is getting all of the other muscles in position so they can do their work. And it's in your face, you have hundreds of muscles that give you expression and things like that. But your whole body is a mixture of these little teeny muscles that are working constantly to get the big muscles in place. And there's only about maybe at most 20 out of the 600 muscles, only about 20 are big muscles and all the rest. And that's why people that do workout, or you see bodybuilders, they're very strong and they can lift up, but they have no agility. It's called muscle bound is a common term, but that means they never develop the little muscles. And so the little muscles are not strong enough to get in position to the big muscles, so they can only move slowly. They can't run fast, etc. So anyway, living in an outdoor environment is much different than going to the health club. So these people would be at the health club daily, doing their reps, doing their exercises, etc. But they would be 5 minutes in the woods, walking through the woods, and they were exhausted. They're going, oh my God, I thought I was in good shape. I'm just like, you know, and they're just like breathing hard. And it's because it's a totally different experience. In the woods, you're using all of your muscles and all your little muscles and developing them by doing things on a daily basis, lifting things up, putting them over there. And it's very different than doing repetitions on a machine. So anyway, I wanted to mention that because there are other things, not only the physical development, but the spiritual development also. And so I'm going to talk about that a little bit here. But first of all, I want to talk about narcissism in science. I mean, you encounter this in business. And people that are so wrapped up in themselves and their vision of the world that they can't step out of it. And so the reason I want to concentrate on science is because recently I had, I would say, an encounter. I belong to research groups, etc. And these are all PhD university people who are involved in hundreds of thousands, literally thousands of different aspects of research. But one in particular had to deal with the Big Bang. So these people are all searching for that golden nugget that will somehow find dark matter or dark energy or solve the Big Bang, all of the missing pieces of the puzzle, although it's so-called accepted, etc. But at the core of all of this is not science. It is narcissism. And if you're not familiar with that term, it's a psychological disorder. It's one of the major 10 psychological disorders that if you were to send somebody to a therapist, that's what they would be, that's one of the potential things they could be diagnosed with. And here's the issue, is that a narcissist in a lot of cases has a very weak image of themselves, but they have to dominate everybody around them and everybody has to worship them and they have to think about, oh, how awe-inspiring what you're doing. You know, and this is like, in a sense, the Carl Sagan image, where he was just completely enthralled with himself and the glory that was bestowed upon him by the entire world, basically, as he did his Cosmos series. And he would go on, I remember, on the Johnny Carson show. One night he was on with a guy I know, Whitley Strieber. Whitley Strieber was a co-host with Art Bell back in the old Art days with the Coast to Coast AM Art Bell show. But Whitley was on there, and Whitley had some, he didn't understand what was going on. Whitley was a novelist, and he worked at his upstate New York house. He had a house up in the, you know, upstate New York woods, and he would go up there to write his books, and he started encountering, we will just say he really didn't know. He didn't know if they were psychological images or if they were real, but he was having visits by aliens, and he wrote a book, Communion, and it's a very good book. And so he was just questioning this whole phenomenon. He said, I don't have answers. He was on a Johnny Carson show. This was late night, for those people who are not old enough. It was like the late night show with, there was Jay Leno followed him, and then various other talk show hosts are there now, much politicized right now instead of just good, fun entertainment. But Johnny Carson had Whitley Strieber, and on the same night he had Carl Sagan. And Carl Sagan was like, head back, I don't have time for such foolishness, was his comment, in a very condescending, arrogant, absolutely typical of a narcissist who's glowing with his own fame and knowledge that he would bestow. And Carl Sagan's, literally, his attitude was, that scientists, and of course him at the pinnacle of it, are smart. They have all the answers. Nobody else could be as smart as they are. So therefore, you are stupid. In fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's the follower of Carl Sagan, who redid the Cosmos series, interestingly enough, rewritten or reprogrammed, but saying the same thing as Carl Sagan, but produced by Andruyan, Carl Sagan's wife, second wife. But at any rate, this whole thing of reeks of narcissism, and you find on the internet people who are, involved in, they have YouTube channels. They're not scientists. They're not anything. They have no degree in anything. They have no professional experience in anything. Yet they'll pick up a topic. And, for example, Electric Universe, there's a number of YouTube channels now that claim they are experts in Electric Universe, and they're just buffoons. They're idiots. They don't have anything to say. And in fact, we did this one time. We took some of these YouTube or the internet pages and examined them with various criteria. So one was hyperbole. One was defensiveness, that everybody's attacking them and therefore they're right. Another one, and these various categories of content. And then the last one was actual science. What actual science or theoretical work was presented there, which was original? And so the end result was that 70 to 80% of it was hyperbole and just, oh, what would you call it, self-admiration and condescending text relative to other people. But there was absolutely no science content. And they kept referring to pat phrases such as about how many decades they'd been doing research, which is ridiculous because YouTube hasn't been around for decades. People have, you know, all of a sudden showed up on the scene. But a big part of it, too, is narcissism, where they have to demand this massive amount of praise from everybody, like putting them up on this pedestal. And so anyway, this research group that I was dealing with recently, dealing with the Big Bang, I would say things like, you know, everything you're doing is circular reasoning, that you start with the assumption that the Big Bang is true because there's a few indicators that point towards it, like the red shift. Objects appear to be moving away in the universe, but that's really not what's going on. The red shifts are caused by something else. And then the microwave background radiation, which they claim is a remnant of the Big Bang, is due to something else. It's due to the cloud of dust and gases that surround our solar system in the isotropies, which are the inconsistencies, the bright and the dark spots and regions in the this 3D map of the microwave background radiation, has nothing to do with the Big Bang. It's simply an image of this dust cloud which surrounds the sun out beyond the planet Pluto, and the densities, the higher, brighter objects are actually planets forming. And you can see these around other stars. Nearby stars, you see this. But when you tell people that their logic and their science is circular reasoning, what's going on really? The issue is they don't listen to what you're saying, and what you're saying is perfectly straightforward and true. But they refuse to look at it. And this is one of the classic symptoms of a narcissist, is that when brought in front of them the absolute truth of their distorted view of the world, when presented with that truth, they just ignore it, or they bring up with, like Carl Sagan, I don't have time for such foolishness. You know, and they don't confront the issue. They either attack the person, which is an ad hominem attack, or they brush it aside as foolishness. That's ridiculous. And of course, today you have the internet, the so-called fact checkers running around the internet, checking facts and dismissing them, you know, as if these people had an inside track on all knowledge in the world and everything that's going on in the world. And so the narcissism has to do with defending yourself at all costs, because you have to remain dominant on this pillar that you've built. And science is like that. And the reason I'm talking about that is because when I went into the wilderness for long periods of time, it's just you. You don't have other people to impress. There's no one there to judge you or be judgmental against you or for you or praise you or anything else. It's just you. And so there's no reason to put on airs. There's no reason to bolster yourself up above anything in reality. So it's a reality check that's very necessary. And as I've said before, scientists will never be good scientists. And I think this gets to the core of the issue, that there are a lot of people with PhDs or advanced degrees in engineering or whatever, chemistry, geology, whatever the field of study might be. They might be very good at what they do, but they've got an ego, they've got their education, they've got their cohorts to please. They have to have published papers, the tenure, you know, the publish or perish tenure track university position. They have to know exactly how to say things, because if they say the wrong thing, hey, it's very competitive. When I was at Cornell, there were bunches of young professors, both math and the physics department, who were vying for tenure. And it's competitive because a lot of these guys washed out, a lot more washed out than got it. So the competitiveness at that level, okay, they got a family, they got the kids are growing up, they don't want to move to another town and drag their family someplace else, so they will do anything. They will say anything. They will backbite. They will steal. They will lie. They will fake results. They will make things look like they aren't, because their objective is not scientific. It's their own behind in their future, in their association with publications and peer review, and how will they be viewed. Oh my goodness, and you call this science? There's no place for science in this organization. And so, like I say, when I went out into the wilderness for an extended period of time, part of it also, to complete the thought, I had to become one with my own spirit. And the other thing is, you have to understand that your spirit, what gives you you, what is you, and the development of your personality. Now, how many people that are involved in PhD programs really stop to develop their personality? Oh, they're involved in solving problems or getting an A on the next test or impressing their professor, their advisor. They're involved in all of this. They don't have time to develop a personality that is required of a scientist or a good engineer. And that's why I said, if you don't take time out and go out into the wilderness and develop your spiritual side of yourself, not only the physical, and cleaning it out, because that helps. Because all of the toxins in your body from modern life are precluding you from becoming the person you really should be, because it's bogging your body down. Your body is not alive. When you are really cleaned out of all the toxins, your body is functioning as it should, taking care of itself, and you're not exposed to all of the radiation, the various microwave radiation we're just immersed in modern life, etc. When you're free from all of that, your body becomes something that you would not recognize. Very important. And so I want to talk a little bit about the spiritual development, because it's not just spirit, because as I said before, you have talent, natural raw talent. You have the ability to develop talents so that a person with very little talent could possibly become a much bigger, say, performer or artist or musician or whatever it is, or scientist, than somebody with a lot of talent who doesn't develop it, or somebody who has a lot of talent. And, when I was in high school, we had a football team. I was on the football team. And we had a player there who was a year older than me, unbelievable athlete, but he just had an attitude as that he was the best, and nobody, he didn't need anybody else on the team. He could just do it all by himself. And you couldn't have a guy like this, because he was off on his own plane. He was on his own planet. And they finally, and he was good in all sports. He was the best pitcher in baseball. He was basketball. He was excellent. He was a guard, because he was not as tall, and then he played football, so he was a running back. excellent, excellent athlete, but just an attitude that just devastated everybody. You couldn't walk. You couldn't be around this guy. You're just a pain in the butt. And the coaches had to deal with this somehow. But at any rate, you get this in the science industry. And when I was going around to Los Alamos, to the private military meetings where I was presenting the electromagnetic propulsion systems, etc., there was always one guy there that was a loudmouth, arrogant, stand up and ask a question that was really a lot of times irrelevant, showing he was really stupid. But everybody kind of cowed to this guy. And I thought, wow, you know, these people keep popping up. And they're, you know, these are narcissists. They're the people that have to put themselves up on a pillar. And science is full of this. And so you cannot have science when you have scientists that are narcissists, that don't listen to reality, that cannot be criticized. And that if you, like I say, take the truth and you put it right in front of them, you're dealing with circular reasoning. And what is circular reasoning? Circular reasoning is where you make an assumption and this all looks very good to you. And so you go out and you do some experiments. In the case of the Big Bang, you look at gravitational lensing, or what you think is gravitational lensing, but it's not gravitational lensing, it's something else. And then you look at the redshifts and you take and categorize stars and galaxies and quasars and other objects according to redshift, and you put this map of the universe together, but it doesn't fit. It doesn't work because the redshift is not due to things moving away from us. So you have quasars with very high redshifts connected to galaxies with very low redshifts. And you go, that's a contradiction, but what do they do? We don't have time for that goofy, you know, those anomalies that, you know, we just won't look at those. They sweep the data under the rug. And I could go on and on about examples where I saw directly scientists literally throwing data away because it didn't fit their preconceived notion of what was going on. Because it's an industry. This is all about money. It's all about power. It's all about publication. It's all about you. It's all about your science. It's all about your theories. And these people are so wrapped up in it that they cannot be scientists. Government money, big, big government money. I talked earlier about Cornell and the Ivy League schools having $40 billion a year in income from grant money and federal funding directly into that university, more than twice the amount of money that they get in tuition. What's their priority? It's not the student. It's not the undergrad that's paying $60,000 to $80,000 to $100,000 a year for tuition. I don't even know what they charge at Cornell now. It was over $60,000 when I was there in 1979. So anyway, how can a university pretend to be science-motivated, science-honest, have honesty toward science when they have this pillar of money that they are worshiping? It's impossible. So once again, the reason I'm saying this is because the other thing that I do is I don't take government funding. I don't have people that sponsor me. I don't have people, because that always goes haywire. I once had a guy who was going to sponsor my show. And we had it all set up, and there was an agreement, and I won't go into details, but it's all set up. Okay, and the first show is coming up, and this guy calls me up, and he says, my wife will be on your show this week, and, you know, and she was, you know, she had some religious thing she wanted to push or something, and I'm like, wow, this was not even discussed. This was not, and so I just cut it off. I said, okay, forget it. This is not going to work. I didn't even get started. And after that, that was, I would consider, a bad experience. And I just didn't pursue it anymore, because I knew so many talk show hosts, they were going to get big. And all of a sudden, and this happened in the early 2000s, there were a dozen talk show hosts that went under. And what happened is that I believe they were like either CIA or plants of some kind. that wanted to get rid of these people, and they come in and they say, we're going to build you up, we're going to sponsor you, they give you $1 million and make your radio show really huge. And they'd come in and they'd accept this and they'd sign documents and everything. And they would have many more channels that they would distribute the show on. And then the people, after a couple weeks or a month or whatever, they'd come in and they'd say, okay, now you're going to start talking about what we want you to talk about. And they would say, well, no, I don't want to do that. Well, and all of a sudden, they had all of this debt build up. They had these contracts with radio stations, with other distribution channels, with advertisers. They had all of this complication build up, which was very expensive. And they'd say, okay, well, we're just cutting you off. And these people would go under. They would lose their radio show overnight because they basically accepted the money from the devil. And I never did that. I could see it happening. I said, I'm working alone. I work alone. I work by myself. There's no funding. I don't have government contracts. And that's one of the things that when Tier 1 people come out to talk to me from the military, I call it military science, They say, how do you do this? You're working, you figure all this stuff out, you don't have government funding, you don't have a staff, you don't belong to a university, and it's because I'm connected to the universe. I'm connected mentally, and I understand how it works, and I don't have any agendas, and I'm not a narcissist. I'm not all tied up in myself. I don't have to put myself up on a pillar. One time, I got criticized for writing my name in small letters. James McCanny, all small letters, no caps. Because I have two caps in my last name, capital M, little c, capital C. But I wrote all small letters. And then this guy criticizes, well, you know. And my answer was, I don't need to promote myself or, you know, my value to my listening audience is because of what I tell them. And it has nothing to do with my name or how many PhDs I put after it or Dr. McCanny or whatever, because that's not important. What is important is the information you can relay to the public that they can understand and use and readily assimilate. Okay, so at any rate, now I want to talk a little bit about the using the same theme, but how does this cleansing of your spirit and connecting your spirit to in the wilderness, how does it help you in the science world? Let me give some specific examples. When I was dealing with the prime number problem, understanding that here's the prime numbers discovered by the Greeks 2,500 years ago, and they never understood the patterns of the prime numbers, and every great mathematician and physicist has worked on that problem of trying to identify the patterns in the prime numbers. The top mathematicians, allegedly in the world, Terry Tao and Ben Green, had written a paper showing that proving, they said, that the numbers, prime numbers, were random. That there was no design, that there were patterns that came and went, but there was no overall design or pattern to the prime numbers. And I came out with a paper which basically found the formula for calculating the prime numbers in groups with very elegant mathematics, group theory mathematics, closure, reciprocity, and symmetry and wave nature and all kinds of amazing properties of the prime numbers. And why could I do that when all of these mathematicians for the last 150 years after Riemann proposed the Riemann hypothesis, which was promoted by Gauss, nobody less than the great Gauss, promoted the Riemann hypothesis as a potential solution to this issue, and it never was, and it never will be, because they had nothing else. They had no other bone to pick on than that. And for the last 150 years since Riemann, that has been the dominant question in all of mathematics. And so what set me aside from all these other people? It's because when I was in the wilderness, I understood a couple things. And one thing you understand is that the universe is infinitely complex. Infinitely complex. So how could anybody ever understand all of the dependencies of the universe and the stars and the and everything that's going on? And, you know, it would be impossible because it is infinitely complex. And if you really study it, even from a primitive point of view, you will realize that the universe is just vastly, infinitely complex, beyond anything man could ever imagine. And so that gave the indigenous peoples a reality of the designer, and they had various different names for the designer. But in this was a tremendous simplicity, that the designer gave you everything you needed in a very simple matter. And they might take this in the form of, say, cedar, which would split easily. It lasted a long time. Bugs did not eat it. It did not rot. It had tremendous fiber strength and flexibility. And it was lightweight. It was like a magical material. Or take something like birch bark, where they made a canoe. Today, people make canoes out of aluminum or fiberglass or other composite materials. But the indigenous people made canoes out of cedar strips and birch bark. And in the wintertime, they would take rocks and they would sink the canoe down into the lake, because keeping it wet was part of keeping it for a long time. And there are canoes that lasted 100 years. Because this is what the designer gave these indigenous peoples. They were the tools that they needed to survive. But great simplicity, tremendous simplicity in the cedar tree, you know, and available for all, making baskets, making cookware, making spatulas, you know, all kinds of implements that they needed, etc. From cedar. It was like to them a gift. But in this infinitely complex universe, man is given the things in a very simple manner that he needs. And when I talk about, for example, the magnetic propulsion systems, and at this point in time, we're talking about 1991, and I'm in the, by the way, I forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, we're in the year-long progression of discoveries, my discoveries. And this show is very important to understand the mental frame that you have to be in to make discoveries. And the reason why most scientists don't make great discoveries, they'll never be great scientists, because they're narcissists. They're tied up in themselves and their theories and everything else. But anyway, when it came to the prime number problem, I made two assumptions. I made the assumption that God, the designer, would not create a number system, and you don't need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, those numbers, what we call the Arabic number system, adopted from the Arabic lettering system, etc. And you don't need those numbers because the prime numbers can be understood on a abstract level without numbers and digits, etc. But anyway, I had to make the assumptions, and this is based on my understanding of the universe from being in the wilderness, in the woods, and understanding that, in a sense, the woods is similar. There's no pattern to the trees. There's no reason why that tree is over there or this tree is here. And that's the thing, too. When people live in a city, it's very, very difficult, literally impossible to connect to your spirit, because all the buildings or up above you, they're absorbing the vertical electric field, and you're not getting any. You're usually not communicating with other people. You're communicating with them about your job, about your all of the other things going on. And so you're not tuned to your spirit. It's very hard to connect into your spirit, although you have relationships, and you have maybe you're married, or you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever, but you don't really connect with them because you're not capable of connecting with them in the city. And you have to be out in nature and also connecting to the vertical electric field. Okay, so anyway, back to the prime number problem of finding the order in prime numbers. It had to be very simple. Something, so I said to myself, because I had been studying this problem since I was in high school. And so all of a sudden I said, okay, I have to leave everything that I've done, all of the research, all of the paths that other people have gone down, I have to forget all of that. Because I taught mathematical analysis at the university level. I'm very aware of the mathematical analysis and what it can and what it can't, what it cannot do. Okay, so I had to make some assumptions based on my understanding of the universe. Now, why had not any other mathematician throughout history done this? Because they didn't understand the universe or how it works or how the designer works or how the grand design works in general. It's infinitely complex. You're not going to understand it, but it's very simple. It's like the cedar tree and birch bark. God is giving you the tools that you need on the basis of ourselves and our ability to understand the universe. He's going to give you those tools. And just like using the electromagnetic propulsion systems, there are things that are provided because the electric currents, for example, in outer space are very diffuse. But God has provided a way, the designer has designed a way for all of that current to concentrate on the spacecraft. It's amazing once you see this, and it's like these are the tools that were given to mankind to travel in space, not rocket ships. Rocket ships are man-made construction, and they're not the way to go into outer space or to move around in outer space. And that's why I said also that man can, on a very primitive level, go into outer space. You don't need computers and you know, high technology to go into outer space. You do not need it. And so understanding how the universe works and that these things are simple and given to man, but you have to understand it, and you cannot be a narcissist. You cannot be somebody that is all wrapped up in yourself and demanding praise, you know, and everything else, because ultimately, narcissists fail. And when they go down, it's not pretty. And they don't know why, and they're grasping for this more and more support, and they're not getting it. And they burn through all of their good friends and their family and everybody else. And, you know, they're at the end of their rope, and they don't know where to go because they were not seekers of truth. They were seekers of praise for themselves. And there's a big, big difference. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here and talk about a passive electromagnetic propulsion system. Okay, now I talked about going to Los Angeles, and I just remind you, this is in the 1982 time frame, this conversation we're having tonight. And also the time frame when I was developing my I had already had a very good development, a very good background in physics, mathematics, etc. But the spiritual aspect that I needed to take me into the future was very important. And so, as I mentioned before, I already had the one electromagnetic propulsion system. I talked about going to the venture capital groups in Los Angeles. And I came across a second one because it occurred to me that kind of like, let's imagine a sailing ship of old, the big Spanish galleons, etc., or a sailing ship even of today. Even if you have a motorized sailing vessel with a motor in it, typically that motor is used very little. It's to get you in and out of a port, etc. And back in the old square rig sail days, you would go out on the ocean, and that was your propulsion. That was your ability to move. If you didn't have wind, you sat there, and there were ships that got caught in what they call the doldrums, the regions where the wind just does not blow for long periods of time. And wow, the people ended up dying on that ship, and I'm sure it was not a pretty sight. This is back in the old sailing days. But in outer space, I thought there must be, and this is once again tuning into the universe, because I had already developed an electromagnetic propulsion system, which was non-inertial. I've explained that. It does not throw something out to make it go forward. There's no heating up or accelerating material to make it go forward, but it's non-inertial. And it comes out with a very high specific impulse because you're not carrying fuel along, which actually becomes payload. But then I thought there has to be a way, and nature would provide this, to be equivalent to the old square rig sailing ships, where you would put this vehicle out into outer space and it would just move with the electromagnetic currents. And I'm not talking about a solar sail. Now, that is not an electric magnetic propulsion system. It simply is a big sheet of material that catches the pressure of the solar wind and is able to move out into the solar system. And, you know, it's not really functional. I mean, it's not something you would do and expect to get someplace in the time frame that you want, because there are solar storms, there's all kinds of difficulties with that kind of a system. So what I'm talking about is something that you would use to move between stars, because it's pretty well proven, if you've done the calculations, that any kind of propulsion system that is inertial, where you have to throw material out the back end of a rocket to go, just the carrying that amount of payload to go between stars and getting up to, say, 50% of the speed of light would be impossible. You could not build a rocket that would do this, because you have to carry along so much fuel, and that fuel becomes payload. It's the old rocket problem, which I've described, the fact that if you double the size of a rocket, you do not necessarily double the payload, because the superstructure has to be heavier, the tanks have to be bigger and thicker, and proportionately, you do not get twice the payload into outer space with a rocket that's twice as big. Okay, so the point here is that typical rockets, either whether they're nuclear, antimatter rockets, or whatever you want to dream up, are not going to get you to the next star system. So there has to be another way. And then again, understanding that the designer would not have intelligent people like us. I sometimes question if the human race is intelligent. That's questionable in itself. But the designer would not create intelligent beings in general and then have them locked up on this planet, because when you see those beautiful stars up in the sky and the moon, you just want to go there. It's part of your instinct. It's part of your birthright. And so there had to be some kind of propulsion system that would get you between stars. And so I had already understood the electric currents that flow between the star systems down the galactic arm. As it's the same type of electrical discharge as in the solar system when you have an excess current of protons in the solar wind. So that got my wheels turning, and I said, I sat down and I said, what is this propulsion system going to be like? This is not, and this is from my engineering background, that I used to write functional specifications. A functional specification is not what it looks like, or the shape, or the packaging, or specifics of the computer integration. None of that. A functional specification simply says, functionally, this is what this thing has to do. And so functionally, what I'm talking about is a propulsion system that simply is set out in the region between stars, and because of the electrical currents there, can pick up on that electrical current and move without anything happening, without using any energy that's internal to the system. My first electromagnetic propulsion system, which you can see in the Atlantis to Tesla book, requires energy. It requires energy on board the spacecraft. And this next one was going to be without any energy input at all from internally in the spacecraft. Obviously, there had to be an energy input of some kind to cause this acceleration, because work is equal to force times distance in physics. And so if you have a force and it works over a distance, there is work involved, and that takes energy, because work is the equivalent in units as energy. So this is going to take energy. So where does that energy come from? It's not magical. It's not free. So where does that energy come from? And so anyway, I resolved this. I understood the physical principles and limitations. So I sat down with the functional specification in hand and came up with a design, which I have not given out to the, let's just put it, military-industrial complex, because they steal things. That's what they do. They offer, and I've seen this a dozen times, where they offer, oh, we all have we have this big amount of funding coming in for, say, electromagnetic propulsion systems, and everybody comes in and puts their designs in and hoping they're going to get funding, and then the military comes back and says, oh, dang on it, you know, all our funding dried up. And then they steal all the technology that all these people came in and gave them for free. And these people don't get a penny. Anyway, that is the, you know, there are con artists everywhere. And 10 years later, they can come back and do the same thing, and everybody falls for it all over again. But the I just wanted to mention the passive electromagnetic propulsion system is exactly that. You put it out in between the star systems, and it rides the electric currents. And I said, this is not a sail. This is something very, very different. It works very different. And there's no internal energy in the system itself. So it's a step above the original magnetic propulsion system that I have, that I, like I say, is printed in the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And so the other very interesting thing about this system of transportation is that I learned about electrical discharges in plasmas with the plasma discharge comet model, that the discharge concentrates on the object. And the example I always use for people that have a hard time understanding this is the backyard bug killer. It's a fluorescent light which attracts the bugs. The fluorescent light does not kill the bug, it just attracts them in the center. And then around the outside, you have two concentric screens. One is at a high voltage on the inside, and then the outside one is at ground potential. They don't have it turned around, because then people would be shocking themselves. So they have the ground potential screen, metal screen on the outside, and then inside they have a high voltage screen, and that's it. And so a bug flies in, takes in the ground potential, comes in at ground potential, flies out into this high voltage zone, and it's enough to cause a spark discharge right where the bug is, and zap, the bug dies and falls down into the plate that's at the bottom of this device. But it's the same principle in plasma physics in outer space, is that the electrical current concentrates where the object is. And so when an object comes into the solar system, it is discharging the solar capacitor, and the electrical current concentrates on this object. It's the way it is. And it's partly due to something called the pinch effect. And this you can find, for example, described in, say, a sophomore-level electromagnetic textbook. That's where I first had contact with it, when I was in college, my sophomore year in physics. And so, at any rate, the amazing thing about this electromagnetic propulsion system that I'm talking about is it uses that principle. And so I've talked about this before. Wouldn't it have been amazing for the sailors back in the old square rig sail days, when they went out to cross the ocean, they put up as much sail as they could given the weather conditions, but the wind did not concentrate on their ship. And so in the electromagnetic propulsion system that moves ships between stars in a galactic arm, so nature, once again, has provided a mechanism, because the electric currents between stars that's flowing down the galactic arm is very, very diffuse, extremely diffuse. So there's a mechanism provided by the great designer to allow this concentration of current right at the spaceship. So if you think about it, it is more than incredible, because the square-rigged sail ships of old did not need more than the amount of wind. The amount of wind that was naturally occurring and hitting the sails was sufficient to move them. Not very fast, but it was sufficient to move them. But in the case of a spacecraft moving between stars in the outer reaches of the galaxy, there's simply not enough electrical current to support the movement of a big spacecraft. But once again, you have to understand, I would not have even looked for this or even imagined this if it were not for my connection to understanding how the universe works, and that there would be provided such a thing. And so therefore I went to look for it. And compare that to people designing nuclear rockets and bigger rockets and higher thrust chemicals, etc., you know, rocket ships to go to the next star. And they publish these in magazines, and it's none of them will work. But what's the difference? These people, it's the narcissism of science and scientists, once again, that they can somehow build this thing bigger. You know, a rocket that we see go up, you know, the space shuttle or the Russian heavy lift or the Saturn V or the other types of rockets. And we see them go off and think, wow, if you could just build one big enough, you could get to the next star. And the reality is, no, you're never going to get to the next star with a nuclear propulsion system. It's just not going to happen. And so, once again, scientists are caught up in this thing. If they can draw it on a piece of paper, they just can make it bigger. You know, just have the engineering come out to where this structure can be much larger than anything ever imagined by man before, that somehow they will succeed. It's putting that square peg in a round hole and just keep hammering on that square peg until it fits in the round hole. That is science today in a nutshell. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here now at the end of the show, a few minutes left. I've been talking about the time period of my development in the 1982, after coming back from Cornell, going up to Canada, coming back, getting a real-world job, high-tech, high-security job in the telecommunications industry, going out to Los Angeles, promoting the electromagnetic propulsion system, being invited to Tier 1 talks, Los Alamos, electric propulsion meetings with the military, and being in contact with these people, and this opening up another phase of my life. And so eventually, of course, I continued promoting all of the things I had been doing. And one of the venues I picked up on was the American Geophysical Union. And so this is a organization that has international meetings once a year, and then it has a biannual smaller meeting. But the annual meeting is scientists from all over the world in all walks of life, all branches of science. And this also coordinated with the fact that now they had, in fact, that they, the fact they had not planned any more planetary probes that were going to go out and visit the planets, etc. The next one that would come would be the venture out to Pluto. But what came next was in 1986, the comet Halley would come by through the solar system, and there would be a flurry of activity of various countries going out. And the United States did not partake in this. So before all of the planned spacecraft would visit Halley's comet, there was a bright young scientist, I believe he was at Goddard, named James Farquhar. And he had control of the ISWE series of satellites, and these were solar wind monitoring satellites. So they had X-ray detectors, they had solar wind detectors, They had various instruments. They had a whole package of instrumentation to monitor the sun. And they were out moving through. They were some of the very first satellites to move through the bow shock region, where the solar wind hits Earth's magnetic field and splits up, etc. And so he had a team of very good scientists. And so he decided, with the help of some friends, that they could take this one dying satellite, ISWE-3, and send it around Venus and whip it out to go to this comet, Jacobini's Inner, which is a periodic comet in the solar system, a small one. And so they did that. And in lieu of that, I wrote a paper called Dynamics of a Small Comet, because the dynamics of a big comet are very different than those of a small comet. Very, very different. Although the same physical principles apply, the discharge of the solar capacitor, the plasma discharge comet model, X-rays to the solar side. And oddly enough, the ISWE-3 satellite had an X-ray detector on it. But because they knew they were going to have to run off batteries and to conserve those batteries, they decided to shut off the X-ray detector, which is an interesting story in itself, because I called up the principal investigators on this satellite and I said, there are X-rays at comets, and you will be the people that discover this is potentially Nobel Prize winning material. And they, of course, they didn't know what I was talking about, because they worked for NASA, and NASA thought that comets were dirty snowballs. And so anyway, they went to their head man, James Farquhar, and I called James Farquhar myself. I said, look, you want to keep that X-ray detector on. You cannot turn other things off, but leave that X-ray detector on, because there are X-rays in comets. They contacted NASA, and NASA said, no, turn it off. Comets are dirty snowballs. There will be no X-rays. Turn off the X-ray detector to save the batteries. Well, of course, finally in 1996, a full decade later, X-rays with comets were accidentally discovered with another spacecraft. But anyway, next week I will pick up on the topic of, and by the way, you can see it if you have my books, at the appendix of the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, is this paper, Dynamics of a Small Comet. And it's where I get into the nitty-gritty of what a spacecraft would actually encounter if passing through the region near a comet. I also told them to go to the sunward side, not through the tail, but of course, listening to NASA, they went through the tail. Okay, well, I'm out of time for this week, so I'll pick it up there next week, but we're moving into the mid-1980s, and a lot of the activity that I had there contacting scientists, going to meetings, promoting the plasma discharge comet model, and being involved with these various organizations. Once again, we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.